Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust. The Things They Don't Tell You. A liberal sociologist and a left-wing political scientist end up saying something remarkably similar. The powers that be are taking pains to keep you ignorant of the past. The lefty, of course, is Dr. Michael Parenti, whose voice has appeared on this and other fine radio programs often. But first, Dr. James W. Lowen, the liberal, describes how bad high school history textbooks are, with some great illustrations of their typical lies and distortions. Did you know, for example, that Helen Keller was a political radical? After learning with great difficulty to speak and read, she devoted her entire adult life to promoting socialism. President Woodrow Wilson of the 19-teens was a terrible racist who segregated the Federal Civil Service and probably set the cause of civil rights back by another 50 years. He was also the world's leading invader of other countries. Compared to him, W. Bush looks like Mahatma Gandhi. Well, at least Indira Gandhi. But did you know that under Wilson, U.S. forces invaded Mexico at least 13 times? And the Soviet Union once? And did you know that, unlike rigid and stuffy old Europe, the U.S. has a great deal of social mobility, and through hard work and luck, members of the working class can advance into a higher social class? Well, if you knew it, you're wrong, because that's a lie. Data show there's much greater social mobility in old Europe, even in aristocratic England and France, than there has been in America for at least a century. The textbooks are lying. Every person the history books talk about is a damned hero, Benedict Arnold and Lee Harvey Oswald possibly excepted. And apart from social mobility, social class does not exist. While your chemistry textbook had a title like Basic Chemistry, your history textbook probably was called something like The Triumph of Democracy, or The Rise of the American People. And it had a red, white, and blue cover with a damn flag waving in the breeze. Are they trying to teach you about the complexities of your past? Or are they trying to turn you into flag-waving super patriots who will be the first to enlist in the army the next time we invade Russia? Silly listener, we both know the answer to that one. Anyway, if you hated history in high school, maybe it wasn't entirely your fault. Here's sociology professor James W. Lowen, interviewed by Ken McDermott Rowe on his most excellent show, History Counts, edited and condensed by yours truly.
In many areas, and in the case I'm talking about, questions about the Vietnam War, the more education people have, the stupider they are. That is, the worse they answer the question, the more counterfactual they. In no other field is this true. I mean, if you look at people who take a math quiz, let's say they're adults, the more math they had in high school, the better they do on the math quiz. The same is even true in American literature, but it's not true in American history. The more history they've had and the more education they've had, the less likely they are to get lots of questions right on an American history test.
You demonstrate that some of the people that we're very familiar with are actually presented in a very inaccurate way in our books. And you talk about, for example, Helen Keller. And you say that, quote, Helen Keller, who struggled so valiantly to learn to speak, has been made mute by history. Could you talk about her?
Yeah, she did struggle, didn't she? I mean, here she was, became blind and deaf in early childhood, and she actually learned to speak, not well, but well enough to be understood, and she learned to write. And what did she use that writing for? Well, our education is usually silent about what she wrote. Books, I'll say, or she became a humanitarian, as I sometimes say to students in class. Could you be more vague?
But at Radcliffe, she became very political, right?
She became very political and very left-wing. She became a socialist. And when that wasn't far enough left for her, she became a Wobbly, a member of the International Workers of the World, the socialist union that Woodrow Wilson persecuted, of course. When the Soviet Union occurred shortly thereafter, she flew a red flag in her study and wrote some embarrassing stuff. Let us follow the rising star in the east. Onward, comrades, onward to the rising star.
She saw that her blindness was also related to economic status.
Blind? The two are tied together, and we can maybe make fun of her today for being so left-wing, But the point is that there was something to it. She became aware that blindness is not distributed equally across the social strata, but it's concentrated in the lower class because of industrial accidents, because of bad medical care for some women, because of syphilitic blindness if they're prostitutes, and so on. So she realized that if you're just going to treat blindness by doing things like improving the Braille alphabet and helping the treatment of the blind, you are treating effect, but you're ignoring cause. So that's why she went so far left.
So why did the history books leave out the last 64 years of her life?
Well, I think they do this because they think it's bad. I mean, I think they do this as a favor to Helen Keller. And, of course, it's just the opposite. Helen Keller would be outraged at how she's portrayed. They also leave out all kinds of other bad things. I treat Helen Keller in a chapter with Woodrow Wilson.
Yes, please talk about him, because as I read the book, I realized that Woodrow Wilson that was presented to me in high school textbooks wasn't the real Woodrow Wilson.
Yeah, he's a great star as he's presented, because they leave out the two terrible things he did in office. And, of course, he was in office for 8 important years. First, he was an astounding foreign interventionist. At my website, and you can take a quiz there, and it's a hilarious quiz. It's the most fun quiz you'll ever fail, but you will fail it. And one of the questions has to do with Woodrow Wilson. And it lists about 6 or 8 countries, and it says, which one of these countries did Woodrow Wilson not invade? And it turns out he invaded 7 of them, and some of the ones he invaded Mexico a total of 13 different times during his administration. He invaded many Caribbean and Latin American countries. And then he topped it off by invading the Soviet Union. And he did this really secretly. I mean, regardless of what we may think about the propriety of George W. Bush's invasion of Iraq, and I talk about that later in the book, at least he did bring it to Congress, and Congress did sign off on it. But Woodrow Wilson not only didn't bring his invasion of the Soviet Union to Congress, he tried to hide it from Congress. His racism was astounding. I think he's the most racist president in the history of the country after the end of slavery, that is, after Buchanan's administration. He segregated the civil service. He segregated the Navy. What this meant was black folks were mostly fired. They no longer could be, for instance, postal carriers in many places. They couldn't be mail sorters, or if they were behind a screen or in a separate room. He kept them out of many jobs that they had kind of routinely gotten as patronage jobs under the Republicans, like Register of the Treasury, which is a rather high job, and port collector in New Orleans. But he did worse than that. He told nigger jokes in cabinet meetings. He loved the movie Birth of a Nation, which is a seriously racist movie, but also a wonderful cinematic advance for its time. It's the first great movie epic. Both this and Wilson's kind of racism from the top helped cause the rebirth of the Ku Klux Klan. People don't realize that when he left office, he was massively unpopular. I mean, Warren Harding won what is still the largest landslide to this day. If you look at the proportion of the vote he got compared to the proportion of the vote Wilson got, wins the prize.
1920, yeah.
Yeah, and Harding is hardly a sterling president or a sterling candidate. So this was really a repudiation of Wilson, and for good reason. Because he had another thing that, and here he is a successful president in terms of the war, so it's really quite amazing that his Democratic successor does so poorly in 1920. But it's not so amazing when you realize that he was such a bad president in these three ways: civil rights, civil liberties, and invading all kinds of other countries.
But after World War II, he's kind of held up as a great hero.
Now, and it really shows how we see history is colored so much by who we are and what the times we live in. And now, in the 1940s and 50s, and for that matter, the 60s and into the 2000s or whatever we're in, the notion that we have not only the right, but the obligation and ought to be in invading all kinds of other countries is commonplace.
Well, he represents what you call the process of heroification. Somehow we need heroes, so our leaders have to be put on a pedestal.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's the same thing that happened with Helen Keller. I mean, almost everybody who's treated in American history textbooks is converted into a hero. There's one main exception, and that would be John Brown. But almost everybody else, regardless of what they did, is converted into a hero. Franklin W. Pierce is my favorite example. He's my candidate for the second worst president of all time. He was so bad that when he came back to New Hampshire, from which he's the only president ever elected, there wasn't even somebody to meet him. They thought he was terrible. But do any textbooks say anything like that about Franklin W. Pierce? They don't want to say anything bad because they might offend somebody. I mean, there's now a Franklin W. Pierce College in New Hampshire, so they've kind of forgotten that he was terrible and now claim him as the only president from New Hampshire. So you wouldn't want to not get your book adopted because you offended somebody in New Hampshire. So let's not say anything bad about Franklin W. Let's not say anything bad about Woodrow Wilson. Let's not say anything bad about anybody.
You write, quote, apart from the European invasion itself, the pestilence is surely the most important event in the history of America. Could you talk about disease and the Native Americans?
The number one thing that the pilgrims were thankful for was this huge pestilence that had struck the natives of New Hampshire. Excuse me. It did strike New Hampshire, but I've got New Hampshire on the brain. Massachusetts, just before they set foot, it struck it maybe in 1617 or 18. Native people were swept by plague after plague. When the Europeans and Africans did arrive on the Western Hemisphere shores, they rapidly communicated diseases to the native inhabitants that almost wiped them out. Now that's, I really am serious, that's the most important, or one of the two most important geopolitical occurrences in the last millennium.
You say it may have been as many as 98% of the Native Americans that died.
Yeah, certainly 90 to 95% of the whole hemisphere. Columbus sets foot on Haiti in 1493. Well, he sets foot on it in 1492, but he comes back to take it, to occupy it in 1493. And at that point, my estimate for the population of Haiti would be 3 million. Some people estimate as high as 8 million, but I think 3 million is probably about right. Well, by 1560, which is just 65 years after Columbus arrives, the native population of Haiti is zero. Now, that's a phenomenon. That's complete genocide, although it's not on purpose. So I'm not sure you should call it that, but it's a complete population wipeout.
But it's not covered in the textbooks.
The textbooks amazingly completely left out this exchange, whether of disease or gold and silver or livestock or corn and potatoes or whatever, in the first batch of textbooks that I read. In the second batch, these new textbooks, that's the biggest single improvement they make. They now treat it with one exception, and that is they still completely leave out the notion of an exchange of ideas. And that's too bad. That's a shame.
We had talked earlier about foreign interventions, and you write about American history textbooks, quote, see our policies as part of a morality play in which the U.S. typically acts on behalf of human rights, democracy, and the American way, end quote.
Yeah.
How does that square with reality?
Well, I think everybody over the age of 8 knows that we don't. It's certainly true that we sometimes try to, but it's also true that often we don't try to, and I'm not even sure that we should try to. That is to say, nations usually try to act in their own self-interest.
Do textbooks, for example, cover the American-backed coups in Iran in 53 or Guatemala in 54?
Pretty much they do not. There's a couple of, you know, individual exceptions that will have a sentence or two about one or another thing. But they do not treat how we stuck the Shah back up on the throne, how we gave chemical weapons of mass destruction to Saddam Hussein, and things like that.
How about the role of multinational corporations?
Pretty much not. Again, in Chile, of course, multinationals played a major role, American-based multinationals, in the unseating of the Allende government. And not only did they, but so did our government. Henry Kissinger, who was Secretary of State at the time, said at one point he didn't see any reason to let Chile go communist, even if its people voted that way. It wasn't going communist, but it was going socialist. It was going kind of the same way Bolivia has recently gone. So, with the permission of the United States, people in Chile killed Allende and replaced him, of course, with an odious dictator who lasted another 20 years and is just one more bad friend the United States had.
Another area that seems that you note that is omitted from textbooks is the question of social class. You say it's really taboo. Why? What does that mean?
Yeah. I've talked with a woman at Scholastic Books, an intelligent, nice person who's, among other claims to fame, is that she has edited more American history textbooks than any other living person. I'm not sure that's what you want to put on your tombstone. but she has. And she said there are three great taboos in American history publishing. And I was able to guess two of them, sex and religion. But I was floored by the third, and the third was social class. And I said, geez, you know, that's about 40% of what we teach in sociology. And I don't mean to be mean about it. It's just a fact that social class influences everything we do. It influences whether you're likely to have hired a lawyer. It influences whether you're likely to have been in the Boy Scouts. It influences all kinds of things. How much TV you watch per week in a negative direction. The higher the social class, the less TV. How long you're going to live. Where you're going to be buried. The textbooks pretty much leave out social class, and they leave it out by not talking about class at all. And when they do talk about class, that's exactly what they do. They say, America, unlike Europe, has very little class system. We're pretty much all middle class, and there's plenty of social mobility. Well, it turns out that that's not true, that in about 1905 or 1910, the United States passed European countries in becoming more stratified, and now we're quite dramatically more stratified than Great Britain, than Japan, than the Scandinavian countries, of course. They are stratified, but we are much more stratified. And that means it's much harder for somebody from the working class to make it into, say, the lower upper class.
You say that educators and textbooks seem to want to inculcate the next generation into blind allegiance to our country. Could you expand on that?
Well, that's evident even just from the title. I mean, I've asked people all across the United States, what was your chemistry textbook called? And they usually don't know, or they say, chemistry. And they're right. It is usually called chemistry, or introduction to chemistry, or principles of chemistry. Even in American literature, you get a title like reader in American literature. Not so in history. You, in history, get titles like Rise of the American Nation, which after we lost the war in Vietnam became retitled Triumph of the American Nation. We get titles like The American Pageant, The Great Republic, and so on. Of the six new textbooks, incidentally, every single one of them is red, white, and blue on the cover, and four of them have the American flag on it itself. So I submit to you, they're trying to get you to be nationalist, to salute the flag, while learning about the past. And those two goals are sometimes in conflict. I mean, it's as if kind of your chemistry textbook was called Triumph of the Molecule, but you know it's not. You're just supposed to learn chemistry, but you're not just supposed to learn and think about history. You're also supposed to be becoming a 200% American, a nationalist. I think the problem really is that the people writing the textbooks don't have intellectual integrity. Therefore, the truth is not as important to them as it should be.
Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she doesn't have a lot to say. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she changes from day to day. I want to tell her that I love her a lot, but I've got to get a belly full of wine. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, someday I'm gonna make her mine, oh yeah. Someday I'm gonna make her mine. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she never does a thing for me. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she keeps the worst company. All her lords and her ladies in waiting, all crawling in the dirt like swine. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but I hope she's the end of the line, oh yeah. I hope she's the end of the line. Her Majesty's living in a land of curtsies, a world of bluish blood and Nazis, yeah. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but I think she ought to call it a day. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl without one good reason to stay. I'd like to take her for a whiskey or two, but I've got a lot of things to do. Her Majesty's a throwaway song, just short of a chorus or two, oh yeah. Short of a chorus or two. A world of corgis and inbreeding, the royal corpse is barely breathing. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl with a circus for a family. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she's stuck with the royal we. I'd like to show around the center of town, but I haven't got a copy for a feat. Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl, but she's pretty much obsolete. Oh yeah, she's pretty much obsolete.
That was Chumbawamba with this week's Royalty Report. I love the line, Her Majesty's a pretty nice girl with a circus for a family. Alas, the circus never fully recovered from the loss of its most popular act, with the unfortunate death of Miss Spencer and her Egyptian playboy lover Dodi in Paris. Not to forget the only person present earning an honest living, the chauffeur. I'm not saying MI6 slipped him a Mickey, and I'm not saying it didn't. Who knows? It could have been MI5. Before that, Professor James Lowen and a funny overview of lies about American history. Lies your kids' teacher are telling even as we speak. Lowen gives what Michael Parenti calls a liberal complaint rather than a radical analysis. Lowen assumes that the purpose of public schools is to educate working-class kids, to encourage critical thinking, to help them understand how things got to be as they are. And he concludes that history textbooks fail simply because well-intentioned educators drop the ball. They don't tell us about Helen Keller's lifelong crusade for socialism because, well, they don't want to embarrass her. Just an excess of gallantry. They don't write anything unflattering about any U.S. president, even Franklin Pierce, because they don't want to offend anyone and lose sales. Lowen does note that one apparent goal of history textbooks is to turn students into flag-waving nationalists. But he stops there. He doesn't ask why, or cui bono, who benefits from this. And much as I admire Lowen's research, I must say that he ends with a grand and glorious cop-out. Why do history books omit so many important things and distort the rest?
I think the problem really is that the people writing the textbooks don't have intellectual integrity. Therefore, the truth is not as important to them as it should be.
So there's a liberal complaint, and a pretty good one as far as those things go. For a radical analysis, though, we might turn to America's favorite political radical, George Carlin. Carlin would reply that the textbook writers didn't make mistakes or drop the ball. They did with good success what they were paid to do. They weren't trying and failing to turn working-class kids into knowledgeable adults with good critical thinking skills. They're trying and succeeding in turning the kids into obedient workers.
There's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason that it will never, ever, ever be fixed. Because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now. The real owners, the big wealthy business interests that control things and make all the important decisions. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. That's right. You know something? They don't want people who are smart enough to sit around the kitchen table to figure out how badly they're getting f***ed by a system that threw them overboard 30 years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly shittier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this place. It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
In a 2008 lecture, political scientist Michael Parenti critiqued the news media, showing their guilt in communicating the same sorts of lies and distortions that James Lowen found in history books. Unlike Lowen, though, Parenti goes on to conclude that the press hadn't failed, didn't drop the ball. It reached its goal quite nicely, which is to advance the interests of the powerful and to turn you into an unquestioning, flag-waving nationalist who will obey orders from your rulers, keep paying your taxes, and support whatever war the powerful decide to wage next. The New York Times and your school's history books are doing the same thing, telling the same sorts of lies for the same purposes. Lowen talked at length about the book's deception through omission. Someone chose not to tell us that Helen Keller was a dedicated, lifelong socialist, that Woodrow Wilson was a terrible racist and gung-ho imperialist, whose policies were rejected by the American people even more than W. Bush's were. Here's Parenti on how the corporate-controlled media pull the same damn stunts as the corporate-controlled history books.
The most common form of media manipulation is suppression by omission. Some people claim that the press is sensationalistic, intrusive. More common than the sensationalistic hype is the artful avoidance. Truly sensational stories, truly sensational, not sensationalistic about Brittany and Paris and all that stuff, but truly sensational stories tend to be downplayed or completely avoided, even ones of major import. Let's say the massacre of upwards of a million human beings in Indonesia back in 1968, was that? 65, thank you. That wasn't even carried in the press. CIA directed and such, right? They destroyed Sukarno's government, all the parties that supported him. The libraries and clinics that the Communist Party had put up in Indonesia were destroyed along with the communists and other all sorts of other people. That's a remarkably sensational story. It wasn't reported. I'll give you an example of what was, for me, one of the most remarkable cases of suppression by omission. And that's the Saddam Hussein story. What we've heard since 91, really, is that Saddam Hussein is a cruel and oppressive dictator, and the U.S. was going to overthrow him and bring in democracy. And we were opposed to him because he was a dictator and because he was in bed with al-Qaeda, which we find as that latter part is false. Now, the truth is he was a cruel and oppressive dictator. What they always left out of all these stories, again and again and again, was the history of Saddam Hussein. They didn't go back. They only went from 1990. They didn't go back just, say, to 1958 and what followed after that. They didn't tell you that Saddam Hussein was created by the CIA, that his first gig, his first job, was to assassinate the prime minister of a democratically elected government in Iraq. They didn't tell you that Iraq had had a democratic revolution with a wide range and coalition of all sorts of people, progressives, communists, constitutionalists, Democrats, all these people. They didn't need to be taught democracy by a U.S. Army coming in 2003. They had a democracy, and that democracy was destroyed. He muffed his first job. He didn't kill the prime minister. He just wounded him, and he got hustled out of the country to Saudi Arabia, some safe house or someplace for a while. Later on, he came back, and he was backed. And that Saddam Hussein, when he took over power, he killed every single progressive and Democrat and leftist and whatever else, including the whole left wing of his own Ba'athist Party. He assassinated them and murdered them. And during those years, when he was at his most bloodthirsty, murderous, torturous, during those years, he was Washington's poster boy. They couldn't do enough for him. They gave him money. They gave him guns. They gave him some bacterial weapons to use against Iran, didn't they? None of that's ever mentioned. I mean, it's just absolutely amnesia. There's an ideological amnesia there. And every reference to Saddam Hussein, all it was that the U.S. was standing up to this bad guy. Never any reference to the reality that the U.S. had created this bad guy.
And let me not omit to mention that New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM at the University of Hartford. The opinions expressed are mine alone. Thanks to Ken McDermott Rowe, History Counts, and MDR Productions for the Lowen interview. And thanks to Mariah Gillardin and TUC Radio for the Peretti speech. Check them out at www.mdrtalk.org. and www.tucradio.org. To send feedback or for more information on New World Notes, please go to newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest New England, this is Kenneth Doust advising illegitimi non carborundum, keep the faith, and remember Claude Coburn's advice to reporters and readers, never believe anything until it's officially denied. Ciao!